You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Today we continue our new political segment, Reviewing the Week in North Carolina Politics. Today's conversation includes voices from both sides of the aisle. Becky Gray is a lobbyist and senior vice president at the conservative John Locke Foundation, and Rob Schofield is director of research at NC Policy Watch, part of the left-leaning North Carolina Justice Center. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
We'll get to House Bill 2 and the repeal proposal, the latest one, momentarily. First, the ongoing power struggle between the legislative and executive branches. Lawmakers passed a measure back in December during a special session requiring gubernatorial cabinet picks to receive Senate confirmation. Governor Roy Cooper sued over this, and it's playing out in the courts. Meanwhile, senators have tried to move forward with hearings, but Larry Hall, tapped to oversee the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, hasn't showed up for these scheduled hearings. After multiple warnings, the legislature took the rare step this week of issuing a subpoena to compel Hall to show up. Becky, let's begin with Senate Republicans. What are they really trying to accomplish here?
Well, they're trying to follow through on the law that was passed, as you mentioned, in December, that the Senate can confirm the governor's appointments for these state agencies. This is laid out in the Constitution. I believe that it's pretty clear. It says in the Constitution that the Senate can do this. Now, they have not done it before. This is something new, and we're seeing a lot of pushback from Governor Cooper, and this is playing its way through the courts as well. A three-judge panel stepped in. At first, they said, no, the General Assembly could not go through with the confirmation hearings. Then that three-judge panel reversed themselves and said, yes, they could go through with it. That's what the Republicans this week are moving on, that assumption. Roy Cooper disagrees with that. It kind of gets down to what is a nomination, what is.
Right. And there's plenty of legalese in here. To quote Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger, the leader of the Senate, most powerful man in politics in the state, he said on Thursday, I think you can read the court order several ways, but it is our belief that the court order does not limit us from proceeding. Why not wait until this plays out in the courts? Why not wait until April or May?
Well, the big thing is because the agency heads, and Larry Hall is just the first one. I don't think anybody's really picking on Larry Hall. But these people have already been appointed to these positions. They have assumed their duties as the agency head. They are being paid as the agency head. So at what point do you say, yes, this person is nominated? What we're hearing from the Senate Republicans is they have been nominated by virtue of the fact that they're on the job, they're doing the job, and they're getting paid for it. And that the nomination is what triggers these confirmation hearings. So they feel confident that they're moving in the direction that they are allowed to under law.
Rob, a Senate confirmation process on the state level, picturing it similar to what President Trump's cabinet nominees are subject to, is that really so bad?
I really think it's a preposterous power grab by the Senate, which has pretty much been consistent with how the Senate has operated over the last several years. They've been consistently trying to accumulate power in a variety of ways. This is just the latest. And I think the controversy that they're confronting right now is in large measure a byproduct of having rammed this bill through in December without having hearings and experts and constitutional law experts come and explain how this might be done. The bottom line is that the Supreme Court actually ruled, the state Supreme Court ruled last year in the McCrory versus Berger case, made it clear that this authority applies to appointing constitutional officers, not statutory officers. And so that's Governor Cooper's position. He's saying, wait a minute, this is an enormous sea change in North Carolina. It's not provided for in the Constitution, and that's why he's suing. And if you think about it as a practical matter, it would be an enormous shift in the power structure in our state. And so to add to that, the fact that the statute itself says that he doesn't have to send over the nominations until May, and he hasn't done it yet, the notion that they can then proceed ahead when the court panel that was appointed by a Republican Chief Justice includes, in fact, a judge nominated by Governor McCrory last year, appointed by Governor McCrory. The fact that that three-judge panel has said, no, wait a minute, you can't go ahead with these proceedings, you can't go ahead with confirmation hearings until he sends over the nomination, and Governor Cooper has not sent over the nomination. It was a silly exercise that took place this week in which the Senate purported to have this hearing, and I don't think it's going to go forward. And the trial in the case in which Cooper is suing them is scheduled for coming up the first week of March. So what's the need to do this other than to accumulate more power in the Senate. That's what this is all about.
So on the right, not to oversimplify, the argument is this is in the Constitution and the governor needs to send these cabinet nominees for before Senate confirmation. On the left is the argument of separation of powers and that this, you know, tips the scale and it, you know, disrupts the balance between the legislative and the executive branches and that it is unconstitutional. What does it tell us to either of you that they can't just go into a room and hash this out? Is this petulant? Is this politics? This, they should be able to work this out, shouldn't they?
You could ask that question for a lot of the controversy that we're seeing at the General Assembly. I think this is a continuation of a power struggle, a disagreement on where the clear powers of separation of these responsibilities of the executive branch and the legislative branch lie. You know, there's clearly a disagreement on what a nomination means. You know, what point is a person nominated? And the General Assembly is arguing that when somebody's on the job, when they've announced that this is my nominee, the person that has received that nomination has said, I accept it, and is receiving pay for it, that clearly triggers the nomination process that begins the confirmation. But one of the things that's troublesome about this, or just kind of another point on this, is with these confirmation hearings, there are three questions that the General Assembly is interested in asking these nominees. And it's, if, are you qualified to serve in this position? Are there any conflicts of interest? And do you promise to uphold the law of North Carolina? So this is one of the things that the General Assembly is bringing up as they are confronting Larry Hall during these confirmation hearings. They believe that the law clearly states these hearings are to go forward and that the nominee is to show up and that they're to participate in the confirmation hearings, and Larry Hall has chosen not to do that.
But that is subjective,
so that's another,
right?
That's another question of, again, it is subjective, but that's one of the key components of this confirmation. Will you follow the law? So that's one of the things that the General Assembly is bringing up through this, is that if you can't follow the law as we see it just for the confirmation hearing, how are we going to be confident that you'll follow the letter of the law in the execution of your duties?
Rob, would you like to respond?
Well, that's several ways to respond to that. That's a pretty remarkable standard, that if a member of the governor's cabinet disagrees with the General Assembly's view of the law, they are thereby disqualified from serving in the position. That's a pretty remarkable stance. But getting back to the question of sort of, couldn't we just hash this out? First off, this is a pretty big controversial constitutional issue. So I think that would be a tough one just to sort of, I think maybe they could hash out some of the procedure. And I think Governor Cooper has tried to send olive branches, but this gets back to the point of the approach that Senator Berger brings to these disputes. He did the exact same thing with Governor McCrory. Whenever there's sort of an olive branch or an offer made from the executive branch, Berger is sort of proud to slap it away. He takes a very belligerent stance. He issues statements in which he doesn't just say we differ and we'll wait for the courts to decide. He makes it personal. He takes swipes at the governor. He did this at Governor McCrory as well, sort of, you know, very personal attacks. And so it's a very rancorous relationship right now, especially from the perspective of Senator Berger. So I think it's going to be very difficult for this to be worked out cordially. I think previous efforts along those lines with other issues have not proved terribly fruitful. So I think ultimately it's going to be up to the courts, and hopefully we'll get some clarity on that in the coming weeks as this panel that was appointed rules on the constitutionality of these hearings.
We'll move on from this for now. Another turn in the House Bill 2 saga came Wednesday evening when a bill with bipartisan support to repeal House Bill 2 was filed. It does not have the support yet of the governor, of hardline conservatives in the House, or of the most progressive members of that chamber. Rob, does this bill have a chance of going anywhere?
I suppose it has a chance of going somewhere. I don't think it has much of a chance of becoming law, nor do I think it should become law. It is really a compromise in name only. It purports to repeal HB 2, but the central, most infamous and controversial part of HB 2, the part about denying transgender people equal access to restroom facilities, we wouldn't just place a moratorium on that, we'd make that permanent. So that central, most controversial part of HB 2 would be made permanent by this so-called compromise. So I don't see how that gets us really very far forward or any further forward in this. I don't think it's likely to please anybody at the national level, any of the national sports associations or corporations. It clearly isn't satisfying advocates for equality or civil rights. And rather remarkably, it's not even satisfying some of the folks on the religious right who are upset about the fact that there's a small smidgen of a proposed compromise in there, perhaps allowing some cities to adopt some non-discrimination ordinances on issues unrelated to bathrooms. So it's with the hardline stance that's been taken thus far by the right, by Senator Berger, by the leadership in the House, in refusing to allow just a simple, clean up or down vote on an HB2 repeal, I don't see how this one gets us very far along.
Becky, I want to hear from you briefly for our listeners who might not know some of the details of this bill. House Bill 186 would repeal HB2. It would also give the state authority over all multi-stall bathrooms moving forward. Cities in the future wanting to pass their own non-discrimination ordinances would be required to give the legislature a 30-day warning, and that would be followed by a 90-day enactment period. So any local ordinance or protection wouldn't take place for another 3 months or so. During that time, opponents could gather signatures, as I read the bill yesterday. And if enough signatures are collected, that would prevent any ordinance or protection from taking place and would put the issue before voters on the next ballot as a voter referendum. Those are just the facts of it. I don't necessarily want you to respond to that. If you would like to, you certainly can address any of those. But do you support this particular proposal for a repeal?
I'm still looking at it, and you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't have a vote at the General Assembly, so whether I support it or not really doesn't matter. There's one other piece of the bill, though, and you described it exactly right, but there's one other piece of the bill that I think is significant, is that it includes a statewide non-discrimination law mm-hmm. that would ban discrimination on the basis of race, sex, national origin, citizenship. Basically, it reflects...
But what did you not mention? Just, I mean, because people are... If I don't note that, our listeners are going to email me and say, you didn't note that it doesn't include LGBT, right?
Race, well, sex. And that's kind of been the whole question of HB2 and the reliance on the Title IX definition of sex. I mean, that's what it goes back to. But this part of the bill mm-hmm. would reflect a statewide non-discrimination law that, as I understand it, reads the same as federal non-discrimination law.
I'm not trying to gang up on Raleigh or D.C. here, but just for clarity, the federal protections also do not include the LGBT community.
It includes sex. And
okay.
that's kind of been the whole question since this whole Charlotte ordinance came down is, what exactly does that mean?
Sure.
I mean, that's been the question. That's been the legal
right.
question and what really nobody can agree on.
And as we saw this week with the Trump administration removing its support of gender identity and bathroom access, something that the Obama administration had supported, the Trump administration pulled that out this week. My read of it, I'm not a scholar, I'm not an attorney, is that this is going to become a state's issue. Rob, in terms of a compromise on HB2, given the nature of politics in Washington, given the nature of the folks who make up the House and the Senate, isn't this the kind of bill, isn't this the only kind of bill that has a chance to send this issue forward? Doesn't there have to be a moderate proposal to this? You might hate it, but isn't that the only way?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's clear that the votes are there, almost certainly there, for a clean repeal. It would be a majority of Democrats voting for it, there's no doubt. It would be a limited number of Republicans. But I do think that let's at least try it first. Let's see if there's if there is majority support for a straight repeal of HB2, take a shot at it. If it's not going to pass, it doesn't pass. Why won't Senator Berger and Speaker Moore allow us to have that vote? If that doesn't pass, then we can start talking about these quote unquote compromises. But this really doesn't accomplish anything. It's got the only other provision it's got in there that's moderately helpful is this idea of enhancing penalties on people who have committed some sort of crime in a bathroom, which is something I wrote in a column 11 months ago and said, okay, you guys, if you're really worried about this, everybody knows this isn't really going to happen. But that's what Governor Cooper said. Okay, we want to extend an olive branch and say, just to make absolutely clear that there's no danger for people in restrooms, we're going to enhance the penalties. If that were the only provision that were in this law and we had a straight repeal of HB2, I think that might could work. But as it is now, I don't think there's any chance that caring and thinking progressives who care about equality for LGBT people are going to go anywhere near supporting this.
Rob noted that he doesn't think this repeal bill, if it moves forward, would appease the NCAA, the ACC, the NBA. What is your stance on that?
I don't think we know the answer to that. And Representative McGrady, who's kind of leading this fight on this particular bill, has said they haven't conferred. You know, they're not doing this for the NCAA. They're doing this to try to come to some resolution on this issue that has taken up so much time and so much effort and sucked so much air out of the room for the last year and a half. That's what the effort is. I disagree with Rob. I think that the votes are not there for full repeal. I think that's one reason why that hasn't happened. What I do see since this bill has been filed over the last several years, as we're moving into sort of the next phase of this, this bill is really gaining a lot of attention. There have been additional members of the General Assembly from both the right and the left who have signed on to this bill. The North Carolina Chamber has come out in favor of it. The North Carolina Realtors Association in favor of it. A lot of these business communities are coming out and saying this is the direction that we believe will resolve this issue. I think it's gaining momentum. I think that there's a very likelihood that this may be what releases that logjam. Now, will this be something that will appease all of the people on the far left of this issue?
No.
Will this be something that will appease all the people on the far right of this issue? No. But are there enough people in the middle, kind of that moderate middle, from both sides of the aisle, that are comfortable enough with this to pass this? I think the likelihood of this, as the discussions are going, we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. I think the likelihood I'm feeling pretty optimistic. But having said that, how many times have we been down this road where we've looked for looks like something is happening? We started this back in the spring with a proposal for a full repeal and a blue ribbon commission. You know, we've gone through several reiterations of these compromises. But this one looks like it's gaining momentum at this point.
And to your point from a moment ago, NC Equality has come out against this proposal. NC Values, a conservative organization, has come out against this proposal. And I would just my follow up, as being a political reporter and being in that building a decent amount of time during the week, I think that there may be the votes to do this in the House if you did it straight up. But of course, what we should note is that
you mean the repeal.
The repeal. If you did a straight up repeal, I think that there might be 61 members of the House who would support that. I'm not convinced that there are 26 members of the Senate who would support that. Regardless, we're never going to see that because Tim Moore puts, you know, power in jeopardy. He puts his reputation at stake, and I think the same can be said for leadership in both chambers, and that's the holdup.
So it's like the issue we just discussed. It comes back to power for the legislators who are running the show. It's not about what's in the best interest of the state. It's about Tim Moore and Phil Berger maintaining their power in the legislature. If this thing, the groups that Becky listed as business groups that are getting behind this are the same people that were the architects of HB2. The only groups that really matter in the business community are the national and international corporations who have launched this boycott of North Carolina and who are exercising it. And unless you bring back the ACC and the NCAA and Apple and all these other PayPal, these giant corporations, it's silly. It's not worth it.
I do want to hear from both of you, and this admittedly is probably something that will make it just into the web version. Maybe I'll be able to cut into the radio version. But we hear a lot about the rural-urban divide. It sometimes seems seismic, a crater-like split between rural and urban, and this falls along religious ideologies and socioeconomic status and ethnic demographics. I'd like from each of you, and I'm to some extent throwing you on the spot here, I'd like to hear from each of you if you have a thought, a suggestion, an idea as to how we, not as policy experts or journalists or politicians, how do we broach that? How do we cross the rural-urban divide? How do we improve on that? And if you don't think we should be improving on that, that's an okay answer as well, I guess.
I think that the urban-rural divide is very real in North Carolina. I think all states struggle with this to a certain degree, but I think that it's even more profound in North Carolina because we are one of the fastest growing states in the country. And what we see from demographic patterns is as people move into North Carolina from other areas, they're moving to the urban areas. That's where the jobs are. That's where the educational opportunities are. That's where people are moving. As people are moving around North Carolina, they're moving from the rural areas to the urban areas, again, because that's where the jobs, that's where the sort of cultural center. And so you start to see this consolidation of the power in the urban areas. Now, where we really see that reflected in decisions made at the General Assembly is when you do redistricting based on one man, one vote. And so when you reapportion those 50 Senate seats, 120 House seats, 13 congressional seats, that changes. Wake County and those highly populated areas pick up representation, whereas the rural areas lose representation. So the decisions that are made at the General Assembly, and I've seen it most profoundly over the last couple of years in education spending and resources and allocation along education needs. Also see it profoundly in transportation needs. Where are those transportation dollars going, relieving congestion or improving safety in the eastern part of the state? Where do we go? How do we do those kind of things? From somebody that doesn't believe in social engineering and making people try to, you know, the government ought not make people move certain places, what do you do to make those communities, keep those communities vibrant across the state? And one of the things I think is looking at transportation and making it possible for people who choose to live in urban counties or suburban counties surrounding the urban areas, that the roads are clear, that there's less congestion, that people can get to work in a reasonable amount of time, but yet enjoy lower property taxes, perhaps a bigger piece of property, those kind of things. That's one way. Something else that I'm hearing a lot, Jeff, I mean, this is very much on the minds of legislators. Mm-hmm. One thing that I'm hearing, too, from almost every one of them is distribution of lottery proceeds. And is there a way to sort of distribute those resources more equitably through lottery proceeds? Now, some would argue the lottery proceeds, when you consider a $50 billion state budget, which is what we have, really isn't enough to make a difference. But I think looking at some of those things and recognizing where the push and pull is and recognizing, I think, the importance to preserve the lifestyle of our rural areas to keep up with the vibrancy of the urban areas is a challenge, and it's one that we're going to continue to look for answers. I don't have the answers, but I know that a lot of people and the organization I work for are looking for some of those solutions.
Rob, how do we start to begin to bridge the rural-urban, urban-rural gap?
Two things that really stand out to me. One is, Becky sort of touched on it, but I think we need to take it to the next level, is redistricting. It's doing away with the absurd gerrymandering that we have here in North Carolina that's the worst in the country. That
goes back to Democrats, just to be clear.
Absolutely.
Democrats and Republicans.
It goes back
all
100
guilty.
Years to before the current parties even existed, but it's clearly been perfected to a new and remarkable extent in recent years in North Carolina. That's one of the key reasons why a state that is evenly divided ideologically has these super majorities of conservative elected officials. We need, and of course those districts are drawn in a way so that they exacerbate the segregation that goes on in our state and cordons people into districts and doesn't allow for districts that might include rural and urban areas together. That's one thing. Another thing we have to come to grips with is the fact that because we have been systematically underinvesting, disinvesting in public structures and systems in this state, our state government simply doesn't have the fiscal capacity to address the problems of our struggling rural communities. It doesn't have the resources. You can talk about tweaking how the formula for divvying up, you know, the small potatoes that is the lottery fund. You know, that goes only so far. We need a fundamental readjustment of how we invest in public services and structures in this country, in the state, and we need to shift our tax system to one that requires the people with the money and the resources, the profitable corporations, the wealthy who are doing so well in our urban areas, to pay more of their fair share. As it is now, we've been moving more and more to a consumption-based tax structure that's affecting negatively our rural areas and handicapping government and its ability to invest in things like infrastructure, schools, all the things that these rural communities need to catch up, things like internet service and broadband, all those things. Those are going to take public investments, public resources, and because of the policies in particular of the last half decade in the state that have systematically cut spending, cut investments in the state back to the levels of the Nixon era, we just don't have the tools. We don't have the capacity to address those problems.
Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch, part of the Progressive North Carolina Justice Center. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the Conservative John Locke Foundation. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jeff.
To hear more of our conversation, visit our website, wunc.org.